Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. This series, we're asking our guests to address some big questions. And today's question is a very fundamental one, life and death. At least two Australian states are considering introducing legislation to allow some people to choose when to end their lives. And like many other issues we're discussing in these forums, this is a very contentious topic. Our two guests are extremely well placed to provide perspectives on this issue. In the order you'll hear from them, they are Dr. Neil Levy, who's a Professor of Philosophy at Macquarie University and also a Senior Research Fellow at a centre I can't pronounce,
Uhiro
Centre for Practical Ethics at Oxford University in the UK. Neil has two PhDs, which I think personally is a bit greedy, but has previously worked at the Centre for Applied Philosophy and Ethics at Melbourne University and at the Florey Institute for Neuroscience and Mental Health. We've put a link on our website to an article that he wrote entitled Euthanasia: More Options Doesn't Always Expand Our Freedoms, Sometimes It Limits Them, which was published in The Conversation in 2016. Following Neil, we'll hear from Dr. Megan Best, who's actually studying for her PhD. Postdoc now. Okay. Oh, tells me I've got that in my own notes. I should read my notes, shouldn't I? Who is a palliative care doctor with Hope Healthcare and a postdoctoral research fellow, my apologies, in psycho-oncology at the University of Sydney. Megan has been a strong participant in the CASE network, which I'd never heard of, but which is a case-based training program for healthcare providers, to which there is also a link on our website. We've also put a link on our website to Megan's first book, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, Ethics and the Beginning of Human Life, which was published in 2012. Welcome to you both. And Neil, what do you have to say about what the impact of legal euthanasia might be on human life?
Thanks, Charles. So I'm going to lay out sort of a big picture, sketching some of the issues, and I'm going to present an argument. Philosophers always present arguments. I'm trying to be fair here. I don't take this to be a devastating argument, and I don't take this to be an easy issue. I don't think this is an issue on which either side is clearly wrong-headed. I do think that, you know, if we consider the reasons, they do come down pretty strongly in the end in favour of well-designed, carefully crafted legislation. But as I say, I don't think this is a lay-down misere. All right, so as Charles mentioned, assisted dying is firmly on the agenda in Australia and many other places. We're seeing the extension of legislation that gives the terminally ill, in a few cases also people who are not terminally ill, but in most cases the terminally ill, the option of ending their own lives. So why is it on the agenda today? Why is it so firmly on the agenda? Well, one reason is changes in medical technology. We've got the capacity to extend life a lot longer than we used to be able to, and some people claim that we're extending life for some people beyond the time when it's of value for them, beyond the time when they judge it's of value for them. Doctors used to call pneumonia the old man's friend. It's an illness people got late in life and it knocked them off. Well, it doesn't much anymore. And now, you know, they're looking for a sort of an artificial friend in some cases. So that's one reason. But another reason is some proponents of legislation just see this as the latest front in the fight for the recognition of individual rights. You could see this, you know, an extension. The last battle, or the next battle, in the civil rights struggle. So there was a time we didn't recognise the equal and full humanity of black people. But through the civil rights movement in the United States and elsewhere,
we came to recognise that. There was a time to recognise the equal and full humanity of women through the suffragettes and through feminism. We came to recognise that. More recently, the equal rights and full humanity of gay people has come to be recognised. And now, you know, the more controversial one, very controversial, very much a live issue given President Trump's decision last night, is, you know, trans rights. So some people see the right to decide when and how you live and when and how you die as a front in that same battle. So you can think of this as sort of an argument from autonomy. The idea is autonomy is a right we have to decide for ourselves certain really important, you know, existential issues. The best analogy here is of all those struggles would be the struggle for gay rights. Because, you know, a basic argument for gay rights would be what I get up to in my own bedroom is nobody's business as long as nobody who's not consenting is involved and I'm not harming anyone. And similarly, you might think, when and how I die is nobody's business as long as, you know, I'm consenting and I'm not harming anyone. So this recognition of autonomy is at the heart of liberal democracy. So democracy is a political system that says, you know, the people get to decide important issues. Liberal democracies are distinctive because they recognise what John Stuart Mill called limitation on tyranny of the majority. There are some things that the people don't get to decide. Big existential issues, majority can't decide. They can decide what our foreign policy will be, they can decide, you know, what our tax rate should be, they can't decide what the meaning of life is. They can't decide what my religion is or whether I have a religion. That's an intrusion into my sphere of autonomy. Why we're all liberals today, or at least most of us are liberals today, is, you know, a big question. Some people think that liberalism is itself a metaphysical view and liberalism is just true. Some people think of it more as just a way of getting on with people. So, I mean, that's the history. Liberalism comes out of the wars of religion in Europe. Catholics, you know, and the Camp Reformation, Catholics and Protestants literally at war with one another. At some point, they recognize neither side is going to win, and they hit upon this modus vivendi, this way of living with each other, saying, okay, we have to recognize that these metaphysical issues are things that we just have to tolerate in one another. And liberalism is the recognition that these metaphysical issues are up to the individual. So, and I'm just going to assume the truth of liberalism here, whether that's as a way of getting on with people or whether it's because you think it's just right. People just do have a right to decide for themselves how these big metaphysical issues go. If that's right, then there's a prima facie argument for assisted dying. I get to decide the meaning of my own life for me, and that means I have the right to decide when and how I die. But it's a prima facie argument, which is to say that, you know, it can be rebutted. And there are two ways of rebutting it, essentially. Two ways that a liberal can recognize. One is to recognize that this right to autonomy has its own sort of internal limitation, which is that autonomy is something that's only valuable if you've got decision-making capacities. You only have a right to decide for yourself if you're a rational being. I mean, just to see this, you know, autonomy is a protection against paternalism. I get to decide for myself these big questions, even if you know better than I do, because I'm a rational being and I have that right. But we don't think paternalism is wrong with regard to children. In fact, you know, that's the word means sort of paternal responsibility, paternal control over a child. And we think that children don't have that right to make those decisions for themselves. you know, they have views and they should be listened to and respected, but they don't get the right in the end to veto their parents because they just don't have the full understanding that autonomy requires. And the other internal limitation of the right to autonomy is, I've already mentioned, which is that I only get to decide things so long as I'm not harming anyone else, so long as it really only concerns me and other people are consenting. So those are the two ways you can attack the argument from autonomy, two main ways in any case. I think, you know, that's how the debates have gone. So, first of all, you can worry that people who would take advantage of assisted dying legislation don't have the capacity to make this decision for themselves. Or you can, you know, this doesn't have to be an absolute. You can say too many of them would make a decision when they don't in fact have this capacity. So it's not something we should be recognising. We should be, you know, legislating in favour of, even if there are some who could use it. And there are two reasons to think that people who might take advantage of this legislation mightn't have the capacity to make the decision for themselves. One is that illness does interfere with capacity for rational decision making. I mean, we all know that even from trivial illness, when you have a cold, you don't do philosophy as well. You can still do it, but you're not as good at it. And a cold's really minor. Flu, and you may not be able to do philosophy at all for a short while. Many of us, you know, even by the time of middle age, have had more severe illnesses, and we know that they interfere with autonomy much more. They interfere with rational decision making much more. So people who are terminally ill are often people who, you know, are in conditions which are not conducive to rational decision making. They're in pain, they're fatigued, they're frightened. These are all things that interfere with capacity decision making. So that's one reason. The other is, I've heard this expressed by a number of psychiatrists, you can worry that wanting to die just isn't rational. It's all by itself, it's an expression of irrationality. So psychiatrists who put this point to me have said, if a patient comes to me and says, I want to die, whether they're terminally ill or not, I know they're suffering from depression. And depression is a major mental illness. You know, people who are suffering from a major mental illness just don't have this capacity. I think these are worries that are worth taking seriously. I really do think that, you know, the wish to die can be an expression of depression. And certainly I think that illness does interfere with the capacity for rational decision making. But this set looks like a good reason to design legislation well and design competence testing. Well, rather than not to allow legislation at all. Competence is something you can test for, and we do it routinely in medicine. You know, we demand that doctors get the informed consent of their patients for treatments. We don't think that very ill patients can't give informed consent to treatment. Not always, in any case. Very often they can. It fluctuates. I mean, for somebody who's with a late stage illness may well lack the capacity on some days and have it on others. And you can test for that. You can use neuropsychological tests. There are well-established neuropsychological tests. Or you can do it in the way Dr. Stanley is doing, by having a chat at the bedside. And usually that's sufficient. It's only when there's a worry that you should be wheeling out the neuropsychological tests. The other worry, the problem with saying it's just not rational to value life is that looks like a pretty substantive claim. And it's the sort of thing as liberals we want to be neutral on. I mean, maybe life is so valuable that you should want to live to the very last second. But that doesn't look like something as liberals we can decide. It looks like, you know, lots of people disagree with that. And there's no argument that I've ever seen which is just so strong that they have to accept it. So this is the kind of thing we want to be neutral on as liberals. We don't want to be building that in. Okay, so what about the second issue? The second issue was that the decision may not concern just me alone. So So maybe I'm a competent individual. Maybe I've come to the view that I want to die and that decision really only concerns me. Still, for me to have the legal right to do that, it requires that a whole, you know, legislative apparatus be in place. And putting that legislative apparatus in place affects lots of people. And it might affect people who don't rationally consent to die in bad ways. How could that happen? Well, one way is by changing the default options. So now somebody who's terminally ill has to make a decision about whether to go on living. They can't just, you know, go on living because that's what you do. You don't have an option about it. Now they might feel they've got a justificatory burden. Why am I occupying this hospital bed when others could be using it? Why am I having these resources spent on me? You know, these are things that now look like they require justification. Why are my family spending their resources on me? And why am I an emotional burden on them? A vulnerable person who wouldn't otherwise consent to die, who wouldn't have the wish to die if it weren't for the fact this legislation was in place, now I feel that they have a sort of a duty to die. Now, again, I think this is a serious worry. We do need to take into account the broader effects of having this sort of legislative apparatus in place. And it does affect society in a variety of ways. To a large extent, though, this looks like an argument for not only well-designed legislation, but for good healthcare systems. You know, opponents of assisted dying often insist, and they're quite right to insist, that dying can be a highly meaningful experience for both the person who's dying and their family. It can be, really be something very valuable. And, you know, up until very late, while people are still able to be articulate and express their views, they will say how grateful they are for having had the time to have this, you know, opportunity to say goodbye to the family, and how grateful the family is. And of course we want to be facilitating that. But to facilitate that requires that we take steps that reduce the feeling that people are a burden on the health system and on their families. You need to have good palliative care. You need to have well-resourced health systems so that families aren't spending, you know, inordinate sums on their relatives and alive. You need to have good assistance for the families and for the dying person themselves. You need to have all kinds of counseling systems and support systems. With that in place, the worry that the dying are going to experience themselves as this burden, I don't think it's eliminated. I don't think it's eliminated. As I said, these are complex issues and there are costs and benefits on both sides. But it can be reduced to the point where it's not an obstacle, in my assessment, to having well-designed legislation. And we should all, you know, both sides should welcome that. Both sides should insist on all that because both sides need it for their own view of what a valuable death or valuable death options look like. And of course we should look to the overseas experience. The overseas experience doesn't seem to indicate that people do experience themselves as a burden on the healthcare system and on their family. Nor does it seem as though they experience themselves as needing to justify their going on living. And that's probably because it remains seen as something that's not done as a matter of course. It remains something that's seen as a big step, you know, a momentous step. It's not, you know, like getting a cavity filled or a minor medical procedure. It's a major thing. The default remains in those countries that have had assisted dying legislation for years. The default remains you'll go on living, and if you don't, most people are going to, you know, question your decision, and they're going to, you know, really take steps to ensure you really need it, and they're going to be regarded as an incredibly important step. And that's important, I think, that we retain that view that the default is to go on with it. We can have the legislation without changing the default, but again, we have to have carefully designed legislation, and we have to ensure that broader social practices support that goes on being the default. So, I mean, if we become you know, blasé about death and dying, then this is the dying legislation. In that context, I think the worry would become much more serious, and the costs would start moving. Whether they'd move all the way to entailing that legislation is not permissible, I'm really not sure. But it doesn't look like we're facing that right now in any case. It doesn't. Something that we need to keep monitoring, so we shouldn't think of this as a step we take once and then, you know, set and forget. So right now, I think, although the issues are complex and difficult, it's not, you know, it's not like the struggle for gay rights in one way, because gay rights goes like this. Either you're in favour of equal rights for gay people, or you're wrong. That really is how the options play out. It's not like that for assisted dying. It's more complex, but I do think the balance of reasons favours allowing to go forth in a well-designed way. Thank you.
Neil, thank you very much. Yes, please. Megan.
I can sit down. Give me. Right.
Let's sit.
Thank you very much. I appreciate very much that the premise of tonight's discussion is that it's not a failure of medicine that's prompted the euthanasia debate, but a call for autonomy, the right for the individual to choose the timing and manner of their own death. And indeed, when we look at the reasons why people request euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide in the jurisdictions where they're legal, this is what we see. International research shows that the main reasons why people want to hasten death is because of psychological, existential, and social reasons, rather than those directly related to physical symptoms such as pain. Loss of the sense of self, loss of autonomy, fear of being a burden, fear of anticipated suffering rather than suffering itself. These are the reasons given by the patients when requesting a hastened death. But despite this, much of the discussion in the media around proposed legislation focuses on the physical suffering of the terminally ill. And as someone who's worked in palliative care, I must say I find it quite disappointing that the selfless work of so many palliative care workers has been ignored, because in fact most deaths in our palliative care unit are quite peaceful and the family is satisfied with care. Yes, there can be suffering at the end of life, but suffering itself is not a medical problem. It's an existential problem which extends beyond physical pain. It's influenced by psychological, cultural, and spiritual factors. The physical symptoms can be dealt with, but the suffering might well remain. For example, imagine we have two women the same age, say they're both 30 years old, they both have the same amount of physical pain. One is in labour, she's about to have a baby, and the other one is dying from cancer. The woman in labour knows that the reason the pain is there is because the baby's coming, and soon she'll have the newborn and the pain will stop. But the woman with cancer knows that the pain is coming from the thing that's killing her, and it's not going to go away until she dies. So even if they have the same amount of physical pain, I think you can see that the woman with cancer is suffering more. Diagnosis of life-threatening disease is recognised as a common precedent to suffering, and it's is recognised as a trigger for the raising of existential questions such as, why me? What am I doing here? And it's quite well recognised now that someone needs to understand the meaning of their existence before they can die in peace. The arrival of the awareness of one's own imminent death can be difficult to process in a society which is youth-obsessed and death-denying. We don't know how to die properly anymore. We're uncomfortable discussing it. We've lost our traditions in the West. I think we could be trained to die by example, but very few of us have seen examples. Most people in the public haven't even seen a corpse. I think also that most people have been ignoring the existential dimension for a long time before facing these questions themselves. And so when they face their own death, they're unprepared, and that's a very scary experience. In our community, the fear of dying is promoted by numerous accounts in the media of the misery that's experienced as life draws to a close. There now seems to be a desire in some people to go from a state of health straight to a state of being dead without having to die at all. Now, currently research into existential suffering at the end of life is in its early stages. I've done some of this research myself, but we've established that spiritual well-being, and by that I mean existential well-being, is as important for physical quality of life as is physical well-being. So your quality of life is impacted as much by your existential well-being as your physical well-being, which means that even at a time when your body is physically deteriorating, you can have good quality of life if your existential well-being is high. And so we're developing some interventions which can improve existential or spiritual well-being in the healthcare setting. Now, this idea is rarely expressed in the public debate, and part of the problem, of course, is there's a lack of understanding in the public debate as to what euthanasia actually entails. I define it as an act where a doctor intentionally ends the life of a person by the administration of drugs at that person's voluntary and competent request for reasons of compassion, which would certainly work well with Neil's idea of what would constitute a well-designed piece of legislation. So the key points are that it's an intentional act by the doctor, motivated by compassion. It's a decision voluntarily made by the patient with no coercion involved, and the patient's mentally competent at the time. I prefer to keep the definition narrow so we can deal with each end-of-life scenario independently, because the ethical difference can be profound. Physician-assisted suicide is quite similar to euthanasia ethically, and also all assisted dying legislation includes euthanasia if the patient cannot actually do the act themselves. But I think part of the confusion in the public domain is not understanding what euthanasia is not. So sometimes euthanasia is confused with stopping treatment that was originally aimed at prolonging life, things such as chemotherapy. So in life-threatening disease, treatment that was originally started in an aim to cure the disease either stops working, so it's futile, or the side effects, such as vomiting, may become so burdensome that any benefit you get from an extra bit of time from that treatment is not worthwhile. At this point, the treatment may not be so much prolonging life as prolonging the process of dying. Now, Neil rightly points this out as one of the reasons why the euthanasia debate has been generated in our society. But what's not well recognised in Australia is that every competent adult patient has the right to refuse treatment, even if it means refusing life-prolonging treatment. And I think if more people realised that, prolonged dying would be less of an issue. And this practice is not euthanasia, because The intention is not to kill the patient, but to allow the underlying disease to run its course. The patient will be kept totally comfortable during this process. And in the same way, taking someone off life support is not euthanasia. It's not flicking the switch that kills the patient. It's the underlying disease that kills the patient. That's why they were on life support in the first place. Another situation that's often confused with euthanasia is adequate symptom control in the terminally ill. Because very occasionally, in someone in late disease, they may have distressing symptoms that require the use of sedation or high doses of pain medication to make them comfortable. It's not euthanasia because the intention is not to kill the patient, but to alleviate the distress of the symptoms. Now, some people would call this practice passive euthanasia because of a myth in the community that morphine shortens the life of the patient. They argue that if we already practice that type of euthanasia, there's no reason why we can't practice the other type of euthanasia, by which they mean the lethal injection, which they call active euthanasia. You see the problem. Now, I know that philosophers have spent a lot of time talking about the principle of double effect to try to get past this issue, but it really isn't necessary because it's all based on a myth that morphine shortens the life of the patient. In fact, extensive international research has shown that morphine in therapeutic doses, sedatives in therapeutic doses do not shorten the life of the patient. In fact, high doses of morphine, when appropriate, may prolong life. There was a study in Newcastle that suggested that was the case, and it could be because the patients are more comfortable, of course. Stopping futile and burdensome treatment and maintaining adequate symptom control are good medical practices at the end of life and should be encouraged in the clinically appropriate situation. When the public has a better understanding of end-of-life care, there's less suffering and less call for euthanasia because the patient realises that they do have some control over what happens. That's personally why I think it is unethical to consider any type of assisted dying legislation until palliative care services are accessible to all parts of the community. And at the moment, only about 40% of Australians who would benefit from palliative care get access to it. Furthermore, if the suffering the patients wish to avoid is due to metaphysical or spiritual concerns, it's not only patient autonomy, but also the social, psychological, and cultural concerns that need to be addressed. But I'm glad we can proceed with the realisation that euthanasia legislation is purely and simply about autonomy. Now, to get to tonight's central question, is there a right to die which the government should support? Well, apart from the fact we're all going to die whether we like it or not, man is free to kill himself, but that does not necessarily mean he has a right to die. It's hard to see the grounds for such a right. He certainly doesn't have the right to compel someone else to kill him. And while many people say that when they're facing death, they would want to be able to request euthanasia, the proportion of people actually requesting it when they're at the very end of their life is quite different. A study done in Sydney has shown that only 2.8% of people presenting to a palliative care service requested euthanasia, and the number fell to less than 1% once treatment had started. Personally, I'm not surprised by those numbers because in my own experience, people at the end of life are more likely to want more time and not less. But I acknowledge that despite all these qualifications, there are a small number of people who do request euthanasia, quite mentally competent, quite rational. Well, first of all, you need to assess the request carefully. Research shows that many so-called euthanasia requests are in fact a call for help, which is misinterpreted by the medical staff. I remember when the euthanasia legislation was in place in Northern Territory in the late 90s, I was working at a clinic in Sydney, and I had a patient come in who was just feeling terrible, and she was telling me just how bad she felt and just kept saying, "I wish I was dead. I wish I was dead." And so I felt the need to interrupt and say, look, I don't know if you're aware, but there's no euthanasia legislation in New South Wales and we don't provide that kind of service. And she looked at me shocked and she said, "Do you think I'd talk like that if you could?" So we need to be careful in assessing these requests. But personally, the main reason I oppose legalisation of assisted dying is not about frustrating the desires of the small number of people who want it, but the greater risk of abuse in the larger group who don't. The Andrews government's talking about legislation with the tightest of safeguards in the world, but if assisted dying was an inherently safe practice, why do we need to keep talking about whether there are sufficient safeguards? Well, let's look at the Netherlands, where euthanasia was legalised in 2002. I won't talk about Oregon in the USA because no one really knows what's going on there. And I'm quoting from major medical journals with these facts. For a start, only about half the cases of assisted dying are reported to the authorities, which is against the protocol. And it seems that those are the cases where they're less likely to follow the guidelines. At the moment, euthanasia constitutes approximately 2% of all deaths in the Netherlands, which in Australia would translate to about 3,200 deaths a year, hardly a trivial number. In some parts of Belgium and Holland, in my discussions with doctors there, in fact, euthanasia is the default practice once somebody has completed chemotherapy. By the time the law had passed in Holland, the courts had already legitimised the death of patients who were not terminally ill. It's legal to kill patients who are not mentally competent. Adolescents aged between 12 and 18 can be killed with the consent of their parents. Early in 2005, a Dutch hospital published their guidelines on how to kill disabled newborns. Under this amendment of the law, it's not only anticipated suffering of the child that is taken into consideration, but also the anticipated suffering of the parents. The Dutch are currently debating whether euthanasia should be allowed for elderly people who are perfectly well in physical terms, but feel they are tired of life. In the Netherlands, unassisted suicide rates are at an all-time high. I think we have to realise that laws, once they're passed, have an educative influence. They mould social attitudes. Daniel Callahan has described the situation in the Netherlands as autonomy run amok. We don't live in an ideal world. Doctors make mistakes with prognoses. The prospect of inheritance brings out the worst in a lot of people. Has anyone seen the movie that won Tropfest this year?
Yes.
Yes. You should see it if you haven't. The recent report on elder abuse in New South Wales by the Parliament showed that the greatest risk for the elderly in this state is financial abuse, or what is also being called early inheritance syndrome. Now, does that mean that human life becomes worthless? Well, certainly there are some people who think they would be better off dead. Autonomy says that if I feel too aged, sick or weak to any longer live a full, happy life, then I have the right to terminate my existence. That act of heroically choosing the time and circumstances of my own demise is the final act of my humanity. This may be what our politicians decide should be law. I'm not sure that it is a parallel with gay rights. I don't think it is just about the individual, because in saying that it's all right for one group of people to kill another group of people, we are changing one of the most basic tenets of our society, and that is that we do not kill each other, even for reasons of compassion. But I'm deeply troubled by the public debate. We've not been told about the vulnerability of those who would be eligible to access the legislation. Niels mentioned the high rate of depression in the terminally ill. And we don't see dying patients on Q&A talking about their experiences of coercion. Patients who don't want the option of euthanasia hanging over their heads. But lastly, I'm not sure why doctors were the ones who were assumed to be most qualified for the role of euthanasia provider. If the state does decide that this is the majority view and the laws are passed, fair enough, but why do doctors have to be involved? I was once talking to a lady in a cafe, and she asked me, when you do that euthanasia thing, do you sterilise the needle? And I thought, that's the perfect picture of how antithetical euthanasia is to current medical practice, because of course it doesn't really matter. Euthanasia contravenes codes of medical ethics that have existed for millennia. We are told, first do no harm. So the question then becomes, well, if not doctors, who should perform the procedure? I came across a paper in the British Medical Journal the other day that gave me the solution. I'm sure you'll appreciate this, Neil. In this, as in other matters, philosophers think differently to doctors. While not unanimous, I think some moral philosophers have deep reservations about legalising euthanasia. Academic philosophers have been prominent in arguing for legislative change, and I think of Peter Singer, for example. Philosophers have argued persuasively for the benefits of a quicker death for suffering people, and that it's difficult to make moral distinctions between withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment, which doctors believe is ethically acceptable, and active euthanasia, which many doctors believe is not. Philosophers, rather than doctors, reflect the views of the public, which in Australia we're told is more than 80% in favour of euthanasia. So the answer's clear. Let philosophers do the job. Lethal injection is a technique that could be easily learnt.
And you don't need a sterilised needle.
You don't need a sterilised needle. Contrary to doctors who worry about conflicts in doctor-patient relationships and a long history of protecting life, philosophers have no professional ethical codes that they have to worry about. Philosopher-assisted suicide would avoid all these problems, and they've got the additional advantage of failing to see the difference between withdrawal of life-supporting treatment and a lethal injection, which makes the latter so troublesome for doctors. But some philosophers may feel that their background and education have not given them training necessary to carry out euthanasia, and I think that's a fair point. Doctors feel the same way. Mm-hmm. Euthanasia has not traditionally been part of our education. And philosophers may worry about their public image if they got involved with euthanasia. But this presumes that euthanasia is a bad thing. And we've heard so much in the media recently about how it's a good thing, a wonderful thing. And so it could only enhance the reputation of philosophers. Of course, philosophers with a conscientious objection to euthanasia would not be expected to be involved. However, if philosophers thought there was a big difference between thinking that something should happen and thinking you should do it, between thinking someone should die and that you should be the one to kill her, perhaps they should carefully think about asking a profession to take on a duty for which they feel ill-equipped and about which at least some of its members have deep moral reservations. So in summary, I would like to say We do need to improve our care of the dying in this country. I believe the ethical act at this stage would be to improve palliative care services rather than legalise an action which would all too easily substitute for the care and compassion people need at some of the most difficult moments of their lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow.